emphasizing that our wives and the ladies among us are helpmeets. And sitting back here, Sheila reminded me of two important points that always ought to be made. And so if I don't get the sermon preached, she works on it, and it's a good thing. Here's the one. It should always be remembered that the role that ladies have is not a result of the curse. The original instruction and the original point that Paul makes, it was the man first, then the woman, is that's a creation principle. It's not a result of the curse, you follow. So that should be understood. Even without the piece of fallenness that I just got done talking about, we still would have the headship order established in creation itself. That's the one piece. And the second thing is, if my thesis is reasonably correct, that the veiling has something to do with addressing the issue of the power that a woman may bring through her femininity, her beauty, her sexuality, to bear upon, possibly in a negative way. Now, I want to say something about the positive sense too. But if that's true, then you should not divorce it from the complete scriptural accounting of the modesty that a woman is to bring to life. Okay, I know, again, we can go bad places with that, but they're connected. If indeed we're talking about beauty, femininity, sexuality, and its warpedness, well, then we're not talking about just a veiling. We're also talking about the way a person is clothed. And it would, you now and then you see this, but it seems really odd to see a lady walking around in very tight slacks with a veiling on her head. Now and then I have seen it. Well, it is odd. It's because you need to see this piece that we're addressing here as being really, again, full-orbed. The language is used in the King James Version. Particularly in 1 Peter chapter 3, would be worth looking at, but we don't have time to do it. But every time I turn to that passage, I point out that the ladies have an opportunity to preach the gospel without saying a word. Do you know it says that in 1 Peter 3? It actually says, well, you don't even have to say a word, but just simply by that modesty of life, if I were to summarize what it says there, in general, you speak volumes into a world that sees it very, very differently today. And I think you know what I'm talking about. So I just want to say that. Listen, I know. Sometimes I feel a little sensitive walking in public. Maybe we go to a public park or maybe even to another public place. And, my wife is really odd. Looks really odd there among a whole generation of people who are really quite comfortable being half naked and a whole lot of other things that go along with it. Ladies, please be encouraged. Yes, there are some people who will make fun of you. But by and large, I know at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, there is respect from a pagan world when they see a lady who has actually, she's modestly dressed. She maybe has two or three or four children in tow, and those children are well-behaved. And they're obviously cared for, and a whole lot of, they walk into your houses, and they are nice, they are refreshing. I told you that we had prisoners living with us. I just know the impact that a lady who is living a chaste, upright, modest life has over the long haul. Don't be persuaded otherwise. It's not true. Yes, there are moments when there is disrespect shown by a generation, but they're just moments. In real time, in overtime, there is deep respect. I know that from what a number of those men have communicated to me. I remember one of them saying specifically to me, well, we heard what you said in the prison. We came and lived with you, and you know what? It's true. It's true. There's still some really good women in this world. That's a testimony. That's a testimony. Ladies, carry it with you. And the third thing I want to say before I leave this subject is that do not walk away from here with hearing me denigrate beauty or femininity or even one sexuality. That's not my point here. There is nothing holy in being deliberately ugly. Nothing. A zero. And I would not in any way want to be misunderstood in that point. I am totally in favor of the ladies caring for themselves and looking attractive and clean and neat, and that whole list of things that goes along with the wholesomeness that is somewhat described in Scripture, or is described in Scripture. And so there is a power there to be exercised in a very positive way. But I'm telling you, it is typically not a power that is recognized at first blush. It's over time. Okay? Whereas that lady that is a knockout right to begin with, but you find out that inwardly there are serious problems. Over time, that respect drops. But the godly woman, the curve is the other direction. And that's what I'm wanting to be encouraging to you here about, and want to be sure that I'm understood, that I certainly do not, I just want to be fair. I know of some people who think that the less attractive you are, the better. Don't entertain that thought. That's not the point. One ought to be attractive, but within the godly parameters that are laid out in Scripture. That's my point. And that is the best beauty of all. Right there. 1 Peter 3 would be the passage to turn to if one had the time to look at. But I need to move on here. I think you received another handout there. And so here we're looking at Adam's response. And we're back in Genesis chapter 3. And I'm talking to the men here. You remember last night that I said, or at least intimated, that I think that this problem, or the problem of, let's just call it general modesty among the ladies, is as much the men's problem, if not more, than it is the women's problem. Maybe just an account here. I'll never forget this moment in my life as long as I live. Sheila and I were with another couple. We were driving down the streets of, I don't remember which town we were in, but we were young. Just married not too many years, maybe not even 2 years, I don't remember how it was, and Sheila and I were in the back seat, and a gentleman, here's a half-clad lady walking down the street, and a gentleman winds down his window and whistles at her. I have a question for you. Pray tell, what are our ladies to think if they see that kind of admiration from us? Why wouldn't they mimic them, pray tell? If they feel like they're in some kind of competition with these people that my eyes are on, these ladies, as I'm out in the public, then I'm even willing to sort of let her know that I admire such and such and such and such, particularly if it is blatant exposure of the body and all of that that goes along with it. It didn't surprise me at all that that marriage had its ups and downs. Gentlemen, if what I'm saying is true today, then shouldn't we exalt that among our ladies and make it clear, both publicly and privately, you're beautiful. Another moment here, Sheila won't like me telling this story, but she might not even remember it, I don't know, but we were at Lake Erie. When we go to the lake, I don't know what you do, and I'm not here to throw stones, but we dress like we always dress. You say, well, how in the world do you? Well, and we walk in the water, don't mind getting a little wet or whatever, but we don't bother just taking our clothes off at that place because it's a beach. We just don't do that. Anyway, we're walking along, and it might even have been an anniversary, and I did, a little intimate here, but I stopped and gave her a kiss and told her I loved her and so on. She said, yeah, even though I look Amish. And I said, Amish ladies who know the Lord are beautiful. You're beautiful. I didn't say that we should say false things if that's not the case, but I'm just saying that I want her to know that in my eyes she is beautiful with her full dress on while all the people around her are naked. Her hair is veiled and she is walking among men as becometh a godly woman. I want her to know I deeply appreciate that. Men, if we're doing the opposite, I have no idea what we expect. I just don't know what we expect. Yeah, well, here I go a little bit on a rant, and that's a little bit of a problem. But so the whole pornography issue and all that, you realize how disrespectful that is to a lady by your side that I have coveted to love and love deeply and exclusively and everything that goes along with that? What does that, what would my staring at pictures and who knows what would that communicate to her? You're not adequate. There's something else. It's a huge problem. Huge, huge, huge problem. And I just want to encourage us to think differently about those things and remember that our attitude as men that we bring to the table here is going to, I think, in the end, is going to determine what direction our churches go here in respect to modesty and veiling and the whole package that we're talking about here this morning. Okay, chapter 3. I'm again in verse 16 of Genesis and looking at the ending verse there. And he shall rule over the ending phrase. So, and thy desire shall be to the husband. So, I'm sorry, God says, but Eve, you've set off a series of events here. You're going to want a husband. You're going to want him on your own terms. But he's not going to have it. Now, listen, this really is at the core of the social problems between men and women today. So here she is trying to wrap him around her little finger, and she works really hard at this, and he's saying, oh no, you're not going to do that. And at least in moments that he doesn't want it that way, that's what he puts his fist down, and he says no, and now you have the wrath that I mentioned. Okay, so the anger of a man. He shall rule her. He says, not going to be this way. That's going to be my way. And I probably have a few notes in that. But first of all, before I get to that, Adam ran and hid. That's what it says in the passage from responsibility. So I should just touch on this before I stay here with this point. When you read the account, you see him in the background, and it says he was afraid, went and hid. Gentlemen, listen, step up to the plate. Step up to the plate and lead that woman and the ladies in your life that you've taken responsibility for. You didn't hear me say dictatorially. You can ask Sheila. Sheila's not a pushover, in case you're wondering. Okay, anybody who knows her knows that's true. Ask her son back there. But step up to what I have found is even strong ladies love to be led. But it takes a man to lead them. Well, become the man that you need to be there. And that's the point here. Quit hiding from responsibility. If a decision needs to be made, step up and make it. when a call needs to be made, make the call. It might not be a popular one, but of course be wise in all of it. The scriptures are clear in this. You're not just dictatorially saying this, that, or the other thing, but you are leading and you're making the decisions by and large. And in case I forget to say it, here's the way I talk about this. A woman does not need more authority. She does need a voice. Absolutely needs a voice. And don't hear me at all talk. I am very deeply, deeply irritated by how these passages, the things we're talking about here, sometimes in some communities, sometimes in very conservative communities, an abusive man can hide behind something and actually be taking advantage of the ladies in his life and get by with it. I am deeply irritated by that, and that has to end. It just has to end. you want to get my ire up? Well, start that kind of thing. Conservative practice and hide behind it. Anybody who knows me knows that I'm pro-conservative. But I am not for a conservatism that permits abusive men to hide and take advantage of the ladies in their lives. Something dramatically wrong when that's the case, the situation. So between Sheila and me, she doesn't need more authority, but she needs a voice. And men, it's our responsibility to create the platforms for that voice to be heard. And that's why I'm saying I don't run my household dictatorially. I draw from Sheila deeply. And we ought to. The ladies have they have perspectives a lot of times that we totally miss. We just didn't see it. And we need that. And so if we shut them down based on their fear to submit, if we shut them down, well, that's problematic. What are we doing? We're just cutting our own throats. That's the way I see it. It's like, why would I do that? I want this lady's perspective. I want her help. She needs a voice. But not more authority necessarily. Skirts the real issue. I've got to skip that one for now. Lives and governs out of his wrath. Verse 16 here. This is a, they tell me, I'm not a professional counselor, but have done a little bit of counseling over the years. But they say that the most counselors will say, the thing that a woman is most afraid of is an angry man. Now, it's interesting to think about it from that perspective. So a passive man maybe is not leading well, but she's not so frightened there as she is of the angry man, because an angry man is out of control. He shall rule over thee, it says here. So much of the abuse that you see today, I'm talking about in the broad world, has come about as a result of the women putting themselves out there in a provocative manner, and then when they find out they're not going to quite get their way, then you know, this man gets very angry, and the first thing, there's all kinds of interchange here, and there can be violence, as you well know, and everything else that's involved with that. I don't want to get off in politics, but the Me Too thing here right now that's going on. I mean, I get it, and I'm glad that there's a call going out to say, men, stop this business. I'm glad for that. But and that one young lady, I forgot her name, Gabby somebody, she suggested to that, well, you know, ladies, maybe you ought to pay a little bit of attention to the way you dress, because that doesn't really have to matter. I mean, they shouted her down and said, now you're making it our problem. I'm sorry, that is a problem. It just is. The thing is, so now we have the ladies wanting to be as provocative as can be. I'm sorry here. I just get rolling on this here. It won't be a go to a real good place here. But it's like that guy that was over there in Europe somewhere, and he was a U.S. congressman or whatever. And so they're on this little set of some kind, and they're practicing kissing and all of that. And then she's all upset because he's stirred up. What was she doing there, pray tell? Or what are these women doing in these hotel rooms of these high and mighty men? Talking with them privately. I know one lady is never going to do that. She's sitting back there. I don't get it. You can't have it both ways, you know. So I'm glad I'm talking to a crowd, I think, that does get it. Lives and governs out of his wrath. He has physical superiority, and that's why you see that. Excuses and blame. And oftentimes, the men in our world today, fear develops. It's either fight or flight. So what do? Some just disappear. Say they can't stand it anymore. They're out of here. They forget the responsibility to either get divorced or just disappear. Men, come on. Our world needs men that will actually stand up and lead with compassion, lead carefully, give the ladies in their lives a voice, but lead. That's what is needed desperately in our day, and that's what is behind this basic point here. Let me see here. I just want to take a look at, I don't have all my papers here in front of me. Where am I at on this? Come back here to this one. Here's a passage. My favorite passage when I'm preaching a wedding sermon is actually from Hosea chapter 2. And you can, I don't have time to look at this one in particular today, but very, very powerful passage. In it, you know the story of Hosea. He is... I never use him as an example to describe how a guy should go about dating, because he's given some instructions to go marry a prostitute. He does. Her name is Gomer. And you probably know the story there well enough. I won't walk into all the details about that. What's very fascinating in chapter 2 is God then, of course, is using this the example of Hosea and Gomer as a metaphor or an illustration concerning him and his people. And in that passage, he tells us how he's going to go about wooing Israel back to himself. And I remember of reading that passage, and it immediately got my attention. I said, well, if this is the way God does it, then this is the way, Melvin, you should do it. And it's in Isaiah chapter 2. Very, very interesting play there. You know what? I can't help but just turn there just briefly and take a look at just a section of the language that is used there in Hosea chapter 2. Maybe just whet your appetite to look into this a little bit. I'm looking at chapter 2, verse 14. God speaking, "Now therefore, behold, I will allure her," speaking of Israel, "and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her, and I will give her her vineyards from thence in the valley of Achor for a door of hope, and she shall sing there as in the days of her youth and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. I'm going to woo her. And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi," which, by the way, is a word used for man. Ish actually is the Hebrew for man. "And shall call me no more Baali, for I shall take away the names of Balaam," and so forth and so on. A fantastic passage here. If you have a translation there, it probably says that thou shalt call me husband, probably, where it says Ishi. Always wondered why didn't they just use husband? Well, I'm not sure that if I'm right on this, but the general idea is Ishi is used here because Ish is man, Ishi is husband, or a specialized, he's a special man, okay? And the term is used here very likely in a way that we might use one of our endearing terms for our wives, you know, honey or dear or the special one that you might actually use if it's for wives, or husband the other way. Special names. You call me Ishi and not Baali. Now, when you see Baali, you can see the word Baal in there. And Baal literally means Lord, the Lord. Okay, so you'll call me Ishi and not that dictatorial Lord that says it's going to be thus and thus and thus. This is the husband that we need to be. You can go on in that passage if you get time sometime and look at the five things that he gives in verse 19, where he says, "These are the methods I will use in betrothing you unto myself." Very, very fascinating, but I'll leave them. Men, the initiators, gentlemen, we lead, we initiate. I'm not even talking about the hard times, the tough decisions, the ones that are really, really hard to make. When Sheila is the most frustrated with me is when I just simply check out. Okay? It's when we're getting ready to go somewhere. My ears are going to get red here in just a minute, but we're getting ready to go somewhere, and she's asking me about, is this packed or is that packed? And I'm saying, well, yeah, I'll get to it later on or whatever. And you know, things kind of go from bad to worse and all those kinds of things. But it's basically because I just kind of have checked out. Okay, I'm present but checked out. That's not initiating. Okay, initiating is at least making sure that things are in place. I will be home at 10. I will be prepared to leave by 10:30. And so forth and so on. Not that wishy-washy, I have no idea. But now and then, you ask her over there, she'll tell you. There are occasions when I'll just say, I don't know. It's not helpful. Okay, so, and I don't want to pound on us too hard. There are times, of course, we don't know. So men are the initiators. There's a great verse in the Bible, we love him because he first loved us. Do you understand the power of that verse? Well, that's it. That love works that way. She loves me because I first loved her. Not saying it should never be the other way around. I'm just saying that it's a two-way street in this way. So, but men are calling here to be the initiators. And I would even say this in respect to the specific, like the veiling. Offer some leadership here. What are your expectations? What's your vision? What do you wish for? Again, you're not hearing me to say lay it out dictatorially, thus and thus and thus. It will be this big and this size and so forth. Incidentally, size does matter. I already said it's a little bit more than just a symbol. You're actually putting hair up and putting it under a veil. Okay, so if it's just a symbol, well, you're not really quite hitting the mark there, is the way I see it. So size does matter, but I'm not here to dictate that. My push here is men, take the initiative. Give some direction. Help the ladies in your life to understand what in your heart, in mind, and spirit makes sense. in these kinds of things. And I would encourage you to study and to think this over and to think deeply. Two of the principles that for Sheila have been very, very helpful to us. One is put first things first. And the second one is the one I want to just mention to you, is always begin with the end in mind. If you read any of Steve Covey, you would recognize that. I pull a little bit from him on this one. But so always begin with the end in mind. Men, this is the call to men today, is to almost every morning ask ourselves the questions, how am I leading this family, and where am I leading them to, and where is the end, and what should be the details of the day that actually help me to get from here to here? How do I get there? That's our responsibility. Let's shoulder up. That's my point here. To be initiator is the clearest indicator of being responsible. I just want to be very, very clear. I don't have bragging rights here. There have been plenty of times that I've been irresponsible. I just know that when I take up my responsibility is when Sheila finds her place the easiest. Okay, and so if I know that, why not step right up to the plate and do so? And responsibility in romance. I'm 62 years old, ladies and gentlemen, young or old. Now let me tell you something. It does a woman good. Does her heart, makes her heart sing when you say, let's go out for supper tonight. Let's do that instead of waiting for the call to come from her. Could we please do something? Tried being an initiator here once, and you'll be absolutely astounded. Finances, child training, education, spiritual welfare, the family, creativity. The last one there, creativity. Listen, this whole thing of beauty and creativity and all that, that's not just the ladies. It's not just the ladies' realm. It's the men who should take a lot of responsibility here. I can't draw worth anything. If I were to quote my father-in-law, some of you know him, the only thing I could draw is flies. That's his typical line there on that one. But you know what? Some of my children, they picked it up from the Martin family. They're pretty good at it, you know. And listen, men, you know what it is? We're out there working and slaving away and making money and all that. Take some interest in what's going on here. Take some initiative in being creative and the creativity of things. I could give a lot of examples here. One of them, my children love to sing. Neither Sheila and I are great singers, but we went out of our way just to actually. I was a school teacher, so I didn't make a lot of money, you know, but I said, listen, I have money for a number of things. I have money for tapes. I have money for music. I have money for things that will actually encourage the softer side, the finer side of life. I got money and time for it. Men, take some initiative here. Don't just wait for the ladies to do it. More could be said here, of course, but going the wrong way here. In the next slide, men, the delegators. To delegate is to empower. To delegate is to trust. Now listen, remember the theme here is, when you're talking about veiling, a woman veiling, we've talked about a number of pieces. It did simply, okay, so Adam was formed, then Eve, she is a helpmeet, and we pull her into that. What I'm saying to you men is if we could only learn to actually use, not use, I hate that term, I don't mean that, but if we could actually learn to facilitate or to bring the best out of that lady so that she could come to her full capacity and bloom, and how do we do it? Well, so if she is to submit, then that means there's something to submit to. And I have found at least a very important thing to do is to be a wise delegator. Now, I happen to be the kind of person, even as a teacher or whatever, I just want to do it myself. I said, well, I don't have time to explain to somebody. Just let me do it. Mistake. Huge mistake. Okay, huge mistake. A huge part of leadership is the capacity to see and understand what the needs are and to delegate appropriately. And so I'll give you an example here again. So in travel, I still fight Sheila about this, but I know it's true. In terms of actually getting things together and remembering what's needed and all that, don't ask me why it irritates me when we're ready to walk out the door. She says, well, did you remember? And I hadn't. And I'm like, what's the point? Far easier to delegate the general responsibility for getting the details of that trip together to her than to me. And far better just to step back and say, you know what, you do that way better than I do. Why not have you do that? And I just want to say, man, when that's done respectfully, I have found lots of very good response from the ladies in my life. When it's, well, do this, do that, do the other thing. Can you, that's different. That's not delegating, that's commanding and shouting at. Delegation is to lay out what the responsibility is and then to empower. To delegate is to trust. And again, for the sake of time, won't go into this, but this is probably one of the biggest issues of all. Where there is no trust, there is no love. Trust is the foundation there. But when I delegate, that lets my wife know, or the ladies in my life, that I trust them to carry forward with that. And that does an awful lot. Men, the wooers. And actually this, I'm going to skip through it here fairly rapidly because this is from Hosea chapter 2, betrothed in righteousness, justice, love, compassion, and faithfulness. And that would take a full sermon just to unpack that. Men are models of sacrificial love. And again, this would be a wonderful thing to unpack just a little bit more thoroughly as to what that sacrificial love is like, but a chapter in the Bible that is very, very clear on this, or verse, Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Now, I know you have been preached at multitudes of times on that verse. My question always is, how do we get past the preaching to the doing? How do we actually demonstrate this kind of sacrificial love? I'm not here to work on that today because, again, it's too big of a subject. But I'm quite convinced that our definition of love is not full-orbed. The statement I make at school all the time is, he who defines the terms wins the argument. And if you think about this very long, you get the picture. The term love itself has been misconstrued. Just to touch on it just briefly, it is basically equated with the idea of, what is the word for it in our day? It's of just being okay with everything. And that's mistaken. That has never been a good definition of love. You know, we've gotten ourselves into a very, very tight spot today because we're almost afraid to spank children and so forth and so on. Well, I detest the brutality that has been involved in that over the years, but I also detest a generation that has forgotten there is such a thing as loving a child when you correct them and correct them properly. And I just touch on that briefly here. To make that point. Men, we need to be models of sacrificial love. I'd like to finish now by actually going to 1 Corinthians 11. If you have your handout there, you have that slide. If not, you can just follow here. I have it basically outlined here on the slide. So, 1 Corinthians 11, a very, very fascinating passage, and I'm not going to take an in-depth look at it. I already told you that I'm not going to do a word analysis. And I'm not going to tear it all apart. I'm going to look at the whole piece, what's actually there. So we ought to read it, and let's do. Verse 1, be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. Now I praise you, brethren, that ye remember me in all things, and keep the ordinances as I delivered them to you. But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is a man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonoreth his head. But every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered, dishonoreth her head. For that is even all one, as if she were shaven. For if the woman be not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, forasmuch as he is the image and glory of God. But the woman is the glory of the man. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. And there you see that repetition from Timothy. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. There's the helpmeet idea. For this cause, for this reason, ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the Lord. For as the woman is of the man, even so is the man also by the woman. Now we recover here a bit, saying, okay, man, just before you think, okay, we were first. Wait a minute, every one of you today. Adam's the only one who escaped this. Every one of you were born in the womb of a lady. Okay, and so don't get proud here. So, both ways. Judge in yourselves, is it comely that a woman pray unto God uncovered? Doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him? But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. But if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. And then it goes on with a discussion about disorder at the Lord's Supper. So I just want to stop there and comment here a bit, and I'll be through here in 10 minutes or so, Lord willing. So I always like to see how passages are bookended. Okay, what's on the front end, what's on the other end? On the front end of this, at the beginning of the chapter, Paul, as he notoriously does, he gives credit, or credit is due. And he says, now I praise you, brethren, that you remember in all things and keep the ordinances as I delivered them to you. I'm so delighted with the way you do this. I've taught, you follow. And then that word that always signals pay attention here, but. So I hear Paul saying, listen, you're doing well on a whole lot of things, but here's a problem you need to think about. And then he begins this teaching that we're familiar with in what is at the center of our weekend thinking here. It's in our theme. So I take it that Paul recognizes here's a problem that needs correction, okay, in the church. Apparently there had been dispute. Okay, so that's at the front end. Here's a problem. I want to talk to you a bit about it. If you look at the other bookend at the end of the chapter or the section there, verse 16, but if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom. Neither the churches of God. I know that this is interpreted variously, but I am so surprised. Almost all the modern translations are clearer here than even the King James Version is on this particular section. It just simply says, no, look, here's been the practice. I'm going to put it in my words. Here's been the practice, the custom. If you want to use a word that we are just very reaction to, the tradition. The tradition of the church has always been to wear veilings. That's true in all the churches. So I don't know of exceptions. And so if this is a point of contention, I don't get it. Paul is saying it. This has always been the custom. It's one of my reasons for saying that for 19 centuries, this was the custom in almost all of the churches. If you want to do a little interesting search sometime, I thought I'd get some pictures up here, but I couldn't find them. Look at pictures of Chambersburg, the town of Chambersburg, prior to World War I, and if you could find some pictures of a typical Lutheran lady. Now, I would suspect probably a little bit more on the conservative side. I'm telling you, you can't tell the difference between them and a River Brethren. They are dressed very, very, very modestly with a full veiling and so forth and so on. Okay, and so I'm just here saying again, and I hear Paul echoing that. The custom, the tradition, the understanding here has always been for the women to veil. And if there's contention, just remember that. That's always been the way things have been. Incidentally, there is a good reason to appeal to tradition. I am not a dyed-in-the-wool traditionalist, but I have learned something. People who are always constantly reacting to traditions almost always, no, I shouldn't say almost always, it feels like I'm throwing a stone here that I don't intend to, but I find them that even when confronted with true truth, just find themselves reactionary if it somehow is connected to tradition. Be careful on that. Traditional practices grow out of values that were once at least embedded in a culture, and they should not be discarded easily and just flippantly, because they tend to have, as I said earlier, some roots. But anyway, those are the bookends. Important points in verses 3 to 5, ladies and gentlemen, order of authority matters. Go to the military. I know maybe a negative example, but in the military, they function totally this way. They know they cannot fight a battle with any kind of reasonable capacity unless the lines of authority are clear. They become a useless group. One of the stories from history that, again, a counter story, but so the Red Army in the Russian Civil War, the Red Army prevails over the White Army, and communism is introduced, and Stalin has his way. Why did that Red Army win? Well, if you look at that with any detail, there was a man at Leon Trotsky, not as well known as Stalin and some of those people, but Trotsky was the military genius of the Red Army. And very, very strict lines of authority, and he would not budge on it. Sometimes I think he would do way out of whack. For example, if there was any raping in his army, there were no questions. You took that soldier straight out and shot him. You didn't hear me say that that's a good thing to shoot people, but that's what he did. If there was breaking out of the lines of authority, he shot them. He just got rid of them. That's not our method. But my point is, he formed an army that was very effective in the 1920s because he adhered strictly to that. It should not surprise us that order of authority in the church matters. It creates effectiveness. It creates capacity. It gives us room and space and ability to actually wage the war that needs to be fought today. So when the women take positions of leadership, and again, I'm not taking a pot shot at that, I'm sorry. There are a few of them who lead better than the men. And that's shame on the men. Okay, but when that happens, it just confuses this. And you don't have to look far to see this. I've been in churches where here's the lady, she's in charge, and the man is actually supposed to be the pastor. But you can see he's passive. He's kind of checked out. He's not engaged. He's not in there doing the work that men are called to do. Why? Well, you got this order mixed up. I don't really care what the reasons are. It is a mistake to trifle with the order that is established in the Bible. And all I can say is, men, if we're too weak to lead, then let's man up. and not fool around with what we find here. So, again, I said I'd be 10 minutes here. Need to get, gender distinction matters. Verses 6 to 10. Again, I'm not going to reread it. This is right on the issue that we're up against today. The way Sheila and I talk about it is, when we talk about these kinds of issues, I want to throw all my weight that I have in the right direction. Okay, so among the arguments that I would present against, let's say, wearing slacks, I'm the first one to say that there are slacks that are modest. It's not like I have a big charge to make there, but I'm telling you, the more we erode the distinction between the men and the women, a proper distinction, the more we become susceptible to the stuff that happened in the 20th century that I read off to you. Much of that would have been stopped right at the beginning if, in fact, the Christian church had said, listen, we have instructions, let's keep them. But since we didn't do that, whether it's the divorce or remarriage issue, since it's the modesty issue, we've got this ball of wax on our hands now. But I just want to be very clear. Sheila and I have said we want all of our weight to be pushed in the direction of saying, she's a woman, I'm a man. here's our responsibilities, and we're gonna carry through with them. I don't know that I know all the details of what should be addressed here, but let's not get stuck in the quagmire that our nation is in today. You realize how much energy is going down the tube as I speak to you, because we're trying to figure out the difference between a man and a woman. The courts are full of all kinds of cases, and our medical world is overwhelmed with enough stuff. Now they're supposed to solve this problem too somehow, and change genders and change the plumbing and everything else that goes along with it. It's like, what in the world are we doing? What are we thinking? What are we doing with the resources we have in a world that needs those resources someplace else? I do want you to hear something. There ought to be compassion in this. I've been around long enough to know that on the issue of homosexuality and transgender and all that type of stuff, there are some people in very, very tight spots, very difficult situations. That's true. Hear me out on this. Policy should never be formed on the exceptions. Policy should be formed on the rule, what is generally true. And our problem today is much of our political system, socio-political system, is too fascinated, too fixated on trying to fix the anomalies and totally ignoring what is generally the case. There ought to be compassion toward the anomalies. I want you to hear me right on that. I don't have all the answers there, but I do know that our hearts should not be angry and, you know, kill them or whatever. I'm not on that page at all. But gender distinction matters, verses 6 to 10. 11 to 12, we're in this together. It's the most blessed thing ever to stand shoulder to shoulder with my wife in the issues of life, whether it's child training, whether it's trying to keep the grass mowed, or whether it's trying to make the checkbook balance or whatever it is. We're in this together. The moment it's me and her, and you know, we've got these oppositions and it's a problem. So we're in this together. In verses 13 to 15, Paul then actually makes an appeal to nature. And that's always just a little bit, I'm not sure what to make of it, but he just says, look, it makes sense. This part at least makes sense. So for the finer feminine characteristics of life, long hair goes with that. Gentlemen, if you're working around a power takeoff, I wouldn't suggest a hair down to about the end of your, down to your belt and sort of swinging around that power takeoff. If you know anything about PTOs, that can create some big issues really fast. Okay, I know I'm using extremes here to actually just point in some directions to say that I hear Paul saying, listen, there's just some sense in this. Men called to be men should have their hair short and should be active in what men are called to. Ladies who are called to the domestic lifestyle and even a professional lifestyle, it's natural for them to wear long hair and to use it appropriately. Well, I'm way out of time, and I'll just kind of stop right there, so to speak. I hope to do some writing on this sometime. I never have. I've done a number of presentations on it. I hope this has been helpful to you in some way. And I really, really want to be encouraging concerning this whole thing as we stand as Christians in a world that has lost the memory of God. Oh, for you ladies, I've had men tell me that. I'm talking about pagan men. Say, well, when I see a lady who is neat, who is careful about herself, she's veiled, she's modest, I immediately think angel, or I think heaven, or I think God. My thoughts go that direction, not the other direction. So may God be merciful to us and give us grace. I'm going to end up with two verses in the Sermon on the Mount, and let them with you, and I'll sit down. Matthew chapter 5, I'm sure you're familiar with this. Ladies, I want you to hear this. Men, I want you to hear this. All godly men and ladies, ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt hath lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? So if we have given way to the pagan siren, not just in veiling, but just in that the whole array of things that are associated, our salt has lost its saltiness, its taste. I, for one, don't mind being different. I really don't. If I'm not careful, I'm almost proud of it. I would just as well say to a world, listen, I stand here, hopefully, as salt and so on. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in his house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. And again, I would emphasize, I certainly would not relegate all the salt and the light to veiling only. But can we understand it to be a piece of it? It's a piece of what we carry into our pagan world to declare the full counsel of God. Let's pray. Father, I just first of all want to thank you deeply for the many, many fine ladies that have been so rich and so powerful and so influential in my life. I think first of my mom, and I just remember the gutsiness that she brought to life, the strength of character, the capacity to correct me, the capacity to direct me. And I remember how she gave herself fully to my father and what he wanted and what he pushed forward for, and have been blessed mightily. I remember my sisters. I remember Sheila. I remember my daughters. I remember those fine young single ladies at Strasburg Mennonite Church who taught Sunday school. I think of Eva and Alice Lehman. I think of people like that. Lord, how rich you have blessed my life with many, many fine young ladies and older ladies, single ladies, married ladies. I look over this crowd, and Lord, I'm praying that you would speak to every lady in this room, from the youngest to the oldest, and help them to understand their dignity before you, their importance, their value, what you've called them to, and what kind of a powerful testimony they can have in a world that has forgotten you. And you even said that they can do that without speaking a word, but just by their conduct. And I pray that you would bless each of them with courage and faithfulness in the face of a generation that is walking away from you. Lord, we trust all to you. We confess we're but human, and even the things we have spoken, probably some of them out of place and out of order, oh, God, forgive us for that. But I pray, take the words that have been spoken, take the word of the Lord that we looked at, and I pray, make it fresh in our hearts. By your Holy Spirit, seal it there, and help us to grow in the grace and wisdom of the Lord. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.